Hello and welcome to the Friday News Feedback for Discovery News. I'm Will Johnson. Every Friday, of course, we do this, and we're joined by Discovery News reporters James Williams and Jorge Ribas. Guys, thanks for being here.
Howdy doody, Will.
How's it going, Will?
It's good. And James is actually here with me in the studio this week. Jorge, via phone.
Back in my cubicle.
Back in the cubicle. You're not on the road. You're just over there, and James is over here.
Right. And Will, I must say, you look great in person.
Oh, thanks, James. I appreciate it. Yeah, the first time we've ever met.
Yeah.
All right, so here's how it works. Every week, we present you with three stories each, from three from James, three from Jorge. Our listeners then get to choose their favorite story of the week, and you can email us or call us and tell us why you chose that story, and I'll tell you how to do that at the end of our podcast. So we will get to the new stories in just a minute. However, what we like to do first is tell you the results of last week's feedback. And as always, got a lot of great emails and phone calls. Are you ready, guys?
Oh, yeah. I'm ready.
And the score currently is 12-11 with who in the lead?
I'm winning.
James in the lead.
But it's a tight race.
It's very tight. It's always been pretty tight. So it was the diatom story that Jorge, you told us about. Could you give us a quick rundown on what that story was about?
Wait a minute.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, I was going to say, wait, that's your build-up?
I'm sorry. That was terrible.
Where's the tension in that?
Okay, let me do it again. It was Jorge's diatom story. Congratulations, Jorge.
Oh, well, I just read it, but you should congratulate the researchers who worked on it.
Jorge, congratulations. I feel good about that win for you.
Thanks, James.
So that makes it 12-12 all tied up. And yeah, that's a good point, Jorge. We only report these stories, or I'm not even sure if it's reporting. all right, so Jorge, what was that about real quick?
Well, it was about these plant-like microorganisms that are found in the oceans, which could be used to manufacture of iridescent cosmetics and paints and fabrics and even credit card holograms. That would be a cheaper and greener way, because in the shells of these microorganisms, there's this iridescent quality that would allow for a cheaper and a greener way to create some of these things. Rather than the artificial way we do it now.
Okay, and actually, I'm very pleased to report that one of the people that voted is someone who can tell us a lot more about this. Her name is Amanda. She is a PhD candidate at Florida International University. She joins us right now. Amanda, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great.
Thanks for joining us here on the Friday News Feedback, and we appreciate your listening and voting for Jorge's story. So tell us about what you're very closely involved with diatoms, is that right?
That's right. I am a paleolimnologist.
Wow.
So I actually study diatom fossils, and diatoms are a great ecological tool because the different species of diatoms tolerate different environmental conditions, and I use fossil diatoms to reconstruct the past environmental conditions in lakes, and their shells are made of silicon dioxide, which is pretty much glass, and that's why they're so shiny and pretty, and their fossils can survive in some sediments for millions of years.
And wow. How big is an average diatom?
Well, they are very small. Almost all of them are microscopic. They range in size from, 5 micrometers or even less up to about 2 millimeters in length. The ones I work with are always less than 300 micrometers, so they're pretty small. I look at them at about 750 times magnified under the microscope.
And when you see them that like close up, do they look like little glass beads?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. They do look like little shiny things, and they do look like glass, and some of them get broken, and they look like they have jagged edges, just like if you dropped a glass.
And in this story I read, they're described as plant-like, but are they animals or are they plants?
Well, they're considered protists. So algae is this weird group of plant-like organisms. So they do photosynthesize like plants, okay, but they're classified differently.
So they're kind of like plantimals.
Well, they move around a little bit. There's some photosynthetic algae that moves around quite a bit because it has flagella or it has cilia, but diatoms kind of just ooze a little bit of slime. They don't move very much. They're really at the will of the water currents to move them around.
Is plantimal a word you've ever used there at Florida International University?
No, I've never heard that word, but I think a lot of protist biologists would really love that word.
Have you studied at all using diatoms in this kind of way as like a hologram or in cosmetics or paints?
I personally haven't, but I know people who actually culture diatoms, mm-hmm, and certain species of diatoms are really easy to grow. As long as they have the conditions that they like, they'll grow quite a bit. It doesn't surprise me that somebody's working on this because diatoms are used in all kinds of applications. I've even talked to people who are nanotechnologists who would like to use their little ornamentations as like parts of micro machines.
Wow.
And diatomaceous earth, which is basically a rock made up of diatom fossils, is used for all kinds of applications, from pool filters or to be mixed with nitroglycerin to make dynamite.
Well, it's really interesting stuff, actually. So you're sort of working in a hot area, it seems.
Yeah, we like to think so. They're very useful little critters in a lot of different applications.
All right. Well, Amanda, it's great to have you on the show, on the feedback, and we appreciate your listening, and thanks for telling us a lot more about diatoms than we possibly knew.
No problem. Thanks for your show.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Amanda.
All right, so there we go. Amanda, PhD candidate, Florida International University. Always nice to have an actual somebody who knows what they're talking about on our show.
Absolutely.
What are you saying, Will?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I was impressed by your questions. I was able to see you guys both in action as reporters. So that was impressive.
That's true.
All right, let's jump into the feedback for this week. You guys ready?
Oh, yeah, I sure am.
All right.
Wait a minute, so right now it's 12-12, right?
Tied up 12-12, yeah. So, again, we come to a very exciting point. Jorge, you want to start it off this week?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, so my first story comes out of Cornell University, where researchers are looking at how our diet, like what kind of an agricultural land footprint we leave by our eating habits. And, you know, you hear a lot about carbon footprints and, you know, driving to work and all that stuff, what kind of carbon footprint that leaves. And I don't ever think about, you know, what we eat and how kind of effect it makes. And what they found is that in this research that if everyone in New York State, they did this in New York State, followed a low-fat vegetarian diet, the state could directly support almost 50% more people or 32% of its population agriculturally. But with today's high meat, high dairy diet, the state is able to support directly only 22% of its population. And this is a study that was published in the Renewable Agricultural Food Systems Journal. And what the researchers found is that while a low-fat vegetarian diet would limit your agricultural footprint, the best and most, I guess, the best, you know, use of land would be a low-fat vegetarian diet, but with a little bit of meat and dairy, not like we're eating now, but more of like 2 cooked ounces per day. And this is because while a vegetarian diet uses less land than a meat diet, vegetables and fruits and grains must be grown on high-quality cropland. And meat and dairy products from, you know, from cows and other animals are supported by like lower quality land. And like right now, you know, there's this lower quality land is more widely available.
Hey, well,
you know, land that can support pasture and hay, whereas like good cropland is harder to come by. So they're saying, you know, by rotating, by using, you know, a strictly more vegetarian diet but with, you know, a little bit of meat and dairy could support more people than a strictly vegetarian one. I think on the whole they're saying that what they said is that a high-fat diet with a lot of meat, which is kind of what normal everyday people eat, is you maybe don't realize it, but you have a lot of meat and dairy in your diet, needs 2.11 acres of land, whereas a strictly low-fat vegetarian diet would be half an acre of land, which I thought was kind of...
I wonder what you could eat to take up, to leave as little, you know, footprint as possible. What would it be?
It's 1 egg and 4 carrots.
Well, I mean, I guess if you just grew your vegetables in your backyard and ate only the stuff that you grew in your backyard, you wouldn't even leave any kind of a carbon footprint with the food that was being delivered to the grocery store that you weren't even going to.
Right.
Your carbon footprints would be like the 8 that it took you to walk out to your garden.
Right.
All right, let's take it over to James for his first story of the week.
My first story is from the University of Chicago, and I did not know this, but apparently there's already been a study that proves in North America that married men have lower amount of testosterone than single unmarried men. This study is the first time that they found that outside of North America. They found it in Kenya, and this is being published in the October issue of Current Anthropology. And they found there's a culture there called the Arial culture, and there the males don't even get married until they're 30, and they don't really do much in terms of raising the kids. They only, less than 1.5% of them consider their wives a source of emotional support. So these guys don't even hang out with their wives. Like, they hang out with their guy friends all the time and accumulate livestock. And even these guys have less testosterone than single men. Once they're married. And what they found, too, is that I guess some of, in this culture, they also do polygamy. So they have, you know, couple wives, and they found that the people that the guys that had a lot of wives had even less testosterone.
It seems to me, well, I don't. There's so many ways of looking at this that I get a little stymied.
Yeah, I
think we're all. Should I make the whoosh sound right
now? Yeah, because I don't know. It kind of freaks me out. I like my testosterone. I don't want it going anywhere.
But it's married.
I know. I wonder now how much I've lost.
All right, James.
We're just gonna get into trouble.
You're starting off with a hot topic. Let's take it back over to Jorge.
Hot button.
Yeah, hot button issue. Jorge, what's your second story?
Okay, my second story comes out of the University of Washington, where researchers there have invented a tool that would let people with disabilities control a computer cursor without, lifting a finger, and this would also help people who, find it difficult or frustrating to use a handheld mouse, and even sometimes I get annoyed using my mouse. The software developed by the university would allow people to move, the cursor just with their sound of their voice. And the device is called the vocal joystick, and it detects sounds 100 times a second and instantaneously turns them into a movement on screen. And what it does is it detects vowel sounds, so like ah, e, ah, oo, and would move the cursor around, and then the sounds k and ch would simulate the clicking and releasing of mouse buttons. And
so you could actually be caught going acha,
acha, and then your mouse would move and then click. I guess
you just right clicked and save file to download.
Thanks.
And deleted all files. And I guess there's already things that are out there for people with disabilities who want to use computers. There's eye trackers. There's SIP and puff devices and head tracking systems. And they're saying that those systems all have their drawbacks. That eye tracking devices are expensive and sip and puff joysticks, people could get actually kind of tiring, breathing in and out every time you want to move the mouse. And head tracking devices, of course, require some kind of a neck movement, and if someone can't move their neck, then they can't use that device. And this would be just a cheaper way alternative. It's a software that people can upload to their computer. And then they also said one of the things that I was thinking when I was reading this is why use those vowel sounds? Why not just say, like, move right, go faster or whatever?
Right.
But they're saying that once you get used to using this, it's a lot quicker and faster to do those vowel sounds, which are just very basic, simple sounds, and to actually say words, and it could take a little longer.
Seems like a drawback might be somebody walking into the room and maybe, picks
up
sounds.
Crazy.
Yeah, going like, ah, ooh, ah, and then, you just accidentally deleted a file.
Yeah, I mean, they don't mention that in the story, but that's something, what would you do at work,
Well, I was going to say, what the most exciting thing about this is, when is this going to be widely implemented in offices around the world? Because it'll make them a lot more interesting to be sitting at your desk.
Well, a lot louder,
a lot
right?
noisier.
Yeah,
and I guess they've been testing the device by working with 8 spinal cord injury patients at the University of Washington Medical Center, and they're still developing it. They're trying to create more advanced controls that would have different aspects of the human voice, like vocalizations. They said degree of nasality. So I guess if you have a nasal voice,
right?
That's pretty cool. That's,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I support it.
I vote for that story.
There he goes again.
Reverse.
Yep. All right, James, back to you. Second story?
Okay, my second story is from the American Dental Association, and they say that tooth loss and dementia may be linked. Apparently, in the past, studies have shown that patients with dementia are more likely than patients without it to have poor oral hygiene and oral health. And in the past, there have been studies that have shown people with dementia have poor oral health, and so I guess they figured that it was the dementia that was causing the poor oral health. But these scientists looked at it from the other way around to see if there was any correlation between having poor hygiene and then dementia. So what they did is looked at a study that some nuns did of the School Sisters of Notre Dame that involved 144 participants. They looked at their dental records from earlier in their lives, and then looked at them now that they're between 75 and 98 years old. And what they found was that amongst those who did not have dementia when they were first examined, those with few teeth, which was they said was 0 to 9 teeth, had an increased risk of developing dementia, whereas those who had 10 or more teeth were at less risk of developing dementia. So the conclusion that they're drawing, and I guess they're not actually drawing conclusions, but what they're saying is that the association between tooth loss and dementia could have to do not only with periodontal disease, but also with early life nutritional deficiencies and infections and chronic diseases that may result simultaneously in tooth loss as well as damage to the brain. So they're saying, you know, you can't really draw any hard conclusions, you know, with this study, but I guess it kind of begs more studies worth looking into if there is this connection between the two.
I don't know. I don't know if I'm convinced.
Yeah.
Is that right, Jorge?
Well, here's what it seems a little like, what's the, specious is the word? Just like, hey, these
depends
guys
on what you're going to say.
These people are crazy and they're missing their teeth, so.
Well, I guess they're, you know, they're, it's interesting that of those people that are, have dementia, that they don't have a lot of teeth. So if there is a link, then maybe, you know, people start, their teeth start falling out of their mouth, then you start, maybe you got to start looking at them a little bit differently in terms of whether or not they may be going to have dementia.
But would it matter that if our, because I guess oral hygiene has definitely improved in the last 100 years, right?
Yeah.
So does that mean that dementia should be less occurring?
Well, it depends on why those things are happening together. If there's something that has changed in the early life, you know, life of people that is still causing that or isn't causing
that. You have to set a baseline for the different types of, for the different timelines of, I don't know what I'm talking about.
I feel like we should just get together and let's just do this, the follow-up study ourselves.
Okay, yeah.
Just get it sorted right now.
Agreed. I'll see you guys in 75 years. All right, Jorge, back to you. Story number three.
Okay, my last story comes out of Newfoundland, where maybe possibly the weirdest and bizarre and little scary tradition I've ever heard of, where residents of small isolated villages in the northern peninsula of Newfoundland have participated in a ritual they call mumming for centuries. And according to the tradition, small groups of villagers, or mummers as they're called, will disguise their identities, go to their neighbors' houses, and threaten physical violence. Whereupon it's the people who live in the houses try to guess the intruder's identity. The study was done by researchers at the University of Missouri Columbia, and it argues that this tradition, which seems a little kind of scary and strange to me, is a manner of communicating trust and trustworthiness amongst the people who live in these villages. And what it is the mummers who threaten the violence must prove themselves trustworthy by actually not committing any real violence. And then the hosts who are being invaded must demonstrate trust by not responding to threats with fear or violence. So it's kind of like people are scaring you, and you have the people who live in the house have to remain calm and try to guess the identities of those who are, you know, pretending to do this violence. And it, you know, these communities are so isolated, and were so isolated, that this was like a way of building trust among them. You know, like your neighbor is going to hurt you, but they're not really going to hurt you, and you know, this is, you trust them for later when things get tough. You can rely on them, I guess. And this was a tradition that took place 12 days after Christmas. And I guess if the mummers were identified, then they, you know, they hung out and had some drinks together. And if they weren't, they just left the house without, you know, revealing who they were.
Well, when you think about it, that's kind of like guys kind of do that today, even like when you joke around with your friends. And there's like, if you listen to a lot of guys talk. I can't speak for ladies, but I know that like amongst guys, there's always this sort of fake kind of violence, or you know what I mean? Like like when you're ragging on somebody, you don't mean it. You're just joking with them. But if you said some of the things you said to your friends to people that you didn't know, it would be really bad, you know?
Well, you'd either get someone would think you're a jerk, or they would punch you in the face.
And I read that study too, and I think that's it's kind of cool, because it's like you're just sort of testing, like you're establishing that you guys are just joking, that I can still trust you, like, you know, you can trust me. I'm gonna say that, you know what, I might punch you in the arm or something like that, but I'm not really gonna hurt you, and likewise. So it does build that kind of trust.
They compared it to, you know, how corporations do these like trust building exercise, like the trust fall. You were just on a greater scale, and you just, you know, you have to trust that someone's gonna catch you when you fall, I guess.
All right, James, back to you for your third and final story.
My last story is published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, where some scientists studied running shoes, and they found that it didn't matter how much you paid for your running shoes, that they are all pretty much good. They compared 9 different pairs of running shoes in 3 different price ranges. So they looked at the cheapest, the mid-level, and the most expensive. They had 43 participants check these out to see you know, how they fell and how well the shoes worked. And none of them were told how much the shoes cost, and they found that across the board there was no real difference between the pricing. They also looked at the plantar pressure, which is the force produced by the impact of your sole hitting the ground, and they recorded that in 8 different areas in the sole using this special device attached to the shoes. And again, they didn't find any difference. So there you go. If you're looking in the market for running shoes this weekend, just because you pay more for your shoes doesn't necessarily mean that they are better.
According to these guys.
Yeah. And these were British. And you know what else is... Did you guys know that the British, they don't call their shoes running shoes?
That's right.
They call them trainers. I didn't know that.
Like cross trainers, but just like, trainers?
Yeah.
Just
like
trainers.
When I first saw the thing, the title is Expensive Trainers Are a Waste of Money. I thought they meant like...
personal gym guys.
Yeah. Like, oh, well then, all right. Maybe I'll go get an inexpensive gym trainer.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, because we call our, you know, our shoes, we might call them tennis shoes, but they're not necessarily tennis shoes.
Yeah.
We call them sneakers. Yeah. Sneaker might seem strange to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. Well, now I'm really curious as to what they call trainers. Well, we call it. What do they call the people that go around and help people lift weights?
Sneakers.
They call them chips.
All right. So that's 3 apiece, right?
Yes.
All right, fans, listeners of the feedback, hope you liked them. Actually, let's do a quick recap, and then we'll tell you how to vote on your favorite story of the week. James, real quickly, your 3 stories.
I'm doing mine in reverse. My first one is expensive running shoes, waste of money. My second one is tooth loss and dementia linked. And my first story was marriage and lower testosterone levels. Oh, no.
Well, nice recap there, Jorge. Sort of had a little rhythm going to it, a little pattern. See how you do on the recap.
I'm not going to do as well. My first story was about that diets with a little meat, not a lot of meat, but a little meat use less land than many vegetarian diets. My second story was about a software device called the Vocal Joystick, which uses voice to surf the internet or use your computer. And then my last story had to do with ritual threats of violence in small Newfoundland communities, our method of creating trust.
A wide array of stories this week for our fans to vote on, so
yeah.
Please vote. We urge you to email us at pod_cast@discovery.com. Very simple, very easy. Just tell us what story you like the most and why is always helpful, too. pod_cast@discovery.com. We also have an 800 number, or it's an 888 number, believe it or not, and you can leave us a recorded message, which might get on the feedback. It's 888-890-6339.
You know, when I picture you giving that 1-800 number, I think of like those old telethons with people like standing by, like 25 people. But it's just you, right?
It's just me.
Okay.
All right, so it's quick and easy to do. Once again, the email seems like most people like to reach us that way, pod_cast@discovery.com. Don't wait, do it now. Okay, so that's it. Then we'll talk to you guys next week. Have a good one and come up with some great stories. Oh, James?
I do have something to say.
Yeah.
I hope everyone has a lovely weekend.
A little persuasion there, Jorge, possibly?
I hope someone has a great year. I hope everyone has a great year.
I hope that...
All right, enough. We're stopping it right there. James Williams, Jorge Ribas, always thanks for helping us out, and we'll talk to you next week. Be sure to join us on the Friday News Feedbag and for Discovery News. I'm Will Johnson.